All right, welcome to The Hours and happy Thanksgiving. We are recording this on Thanksgiving. What better way to express gratitude than to jump on The Hours? I enjoy it. And I'm also very excited to be doing this with Claire. And Claire, very grateful for you in general, as you and I started this Savvy coaching journey together 3 years ago, completely remote. Reconnected on Twitter after coaching together. Look where we are now. We've got thousands of coaches all across the world in our Savvy coaching community. So very thankful for you today.
Who would have thought? Look at us now. Yeah. Grateful as well. Grateful to be here today. Grateful to be here for the past 3 years. Grateful for our professional, personal relationship and the impact that it's had.
Speaking of across the world, Claire is dialing in remotely from Bali. It's 11 p.m. her time. Grateful for you jumping on. We got early morning for me. What is something that you have learned, observed, like to share about working remote and doing the digital nomad thing for this this time period?
Yeah, I think it's honestly just that the possibilities are endless. The range of people that I've met, from 18-year-olds to 60-year-olds from every country, across the few countries that I've visited, both in the past month, as well as my years of travel before that, it's just been reaffirmed that it's like, you can do what you want, when you want, where you want, if that's really important to you. So people just kind of living their dream, making a life that works for themselves, and knowing that there's a country that the culture suits them, there's a pace of life that a certain area of the world suits, there's a time zone that suits them, whether that's like working at night or working less, because that's just normal in some countries. So the opportunity is out there. And if you don't feel like you fit in a certain area, explore, because there are opportunities and lifestyles that are different and very much accepted and normal outside of North America. So be curious, check it out.
Gosh, I love traveling. Of all the places you've been, and I'd be interested for anyone that is maybe watching this on YouTube to drop a comment. I really enjoy seeing all the comments on the YouTube streams. Drop a comment in the community. If you're in the community, I'll ask you this, Claire. What has been one of your favorite places to visit and why?
New Zealand. Easy answer. I've loved a lot of places for a lot of different reasons, but New Zealand always comes to the forefront because it is so diverse. You can go tropical to snowboarding. You can go beaches. If you like wine, if you like food, if you like culture, if you like art, if you like the city life, country life, there really is a lot in a tight area. Just good people, beautiful landscape. So a lot to see. I know it's far, but if you can make it there, I highly recommend.
Okay. I like it. I'm gonna go Barcelona. I've been there 3 times. And for similar answers, I love the architecture of Barcelona, and I love the history. Throughout like the last few thousand years, there have been so many different waves of occupation in that area. So just love that. Love the food as well. I love the pace of life. I mean, you mentioned it, like you'll be walking at 11 a.m. and walking past every shop is closed. Still, it's like, what's going on? And then you'll be walking at 2 a.m. and every shop is open. And it's just so fascinating. So that's what I would say. I think travel is a beautiful and wonderful thing. We'd greatly encourage it. And we'll transition now from our small question to the big question of the day. And it seems very unrelated: world travel to in-game responsibilities with your staff. But this is a very timely one, as right now you're kicking off your games. In fact, speaking with a high school coach last night, they are going into a Thanksgiving weekend tournament. It's really the kickoff for their whole season. They've been preparing and they had a lot of questions. And I think this one will serve. Claire, how would one manage the in-game responsibilities of a coaching staff? You have been on many coaching staffs and you had more experience even in being an assistant coach. How would you recommend that they do that?
Yeah, I think it's huge. Like we know that roles for players are massive. Like that is what leads to success. If they feel confident in their roles, if they feel clear in their roles. And I think we can forget about that for assistant coaches. So if you can get that down, you're at least on the right track. So I have three main things that I would suggest for that. And I'd say these are in priority because I know some of the coaches we work with, they have no assistant coaches. Others have a team of 10 paid volunteers, like this whole combo of support.
Watching NBA right now, it blows my mind. I think there's more staff than players. Yeah. I mean, there it's an army of dry fits back there. Now that they all dress the same, I feel like I recognize them more. Yeah, it's crazy. All right.
It's wild. On the bench, behind the bench, in the front row of the fans, who knows? yeah. So I would say, okay, number one is if you have someone to connect with players. I know some head coaches, that is their vibe. They like to connect with players, but ultimately you don't have time for that in the game. Even if you do it a bit, it's not as much as is needed, whether that's a debrief after somebody subs out, if that's connecting with somebody before they sub in, if it's just keeping the bench engaged to know that they are important as well. If all you can do is have an assistant coach connect with players before they go in, as they come out, being that second voice, being an echo of like the core pieces that you've talked about, that is huge. So that's kind of my non-negotiable. If you have one assistant coach, make them connect with players so that the players feel cared for, they're prepared to come off the floor, and they are knowing that they haven't been subbed off for some random reason, or if it is a specific reason, they know what it is and they feel prepared to go back in. Connecting with players, number one. I've had that role everywhere from fifth grade all the way through college. It's important no matter what level you're coaching. Second would be stats. I'd go stats before anything extra or like feedback, because there's so many moments in a game where what you're feeling may not be factual. And at least having someone who's in tune with the numbers, whether that's the numbers that come from the stats table, or if that's stats that you have designated about what matters to you, that is going to at least provide some feedback, provide like sounding board of what you're saying, some numbers to back it up in, you know, whether you're playing quarters, whether it's at halftime, whether it's in timeouts, somebody who's tracking that. So having some objective numbers to either support what you're already saying or reel you back in when you're getting too fired up. Stats is huge. That was one that I held for a long time at the college level, with stats, both checking stats from the scorers table at quarters and halves to just be like, hey, here's a quick summary to back up what you're going to say as the head coach at halftime. Or we had a few stats related to lock left, related to rebounding, where it's like, okay, we've gotten these deflections. It's getting to the right hand side of the floor like 50% of the time. We need to like get more in the lane. Rebounding, we're not at the specific ratio that we've set. So having those numbers was huge for us as a coaching staff. And so I feel really comfortable and confident in that role and would highly recommend after connecting with players. Third and final would be that observation and adjustment person. So like if you have your right-hand man who's like, hey, this is what I'm seeing us do. This is what I'm seeing the other team do. They're on the lookout and have really like high IQ, and you trust them to kind of be in your ear about the adjustments that you need to make. That would be ideal. So if you can have all three of those people, somebody who connects, somebody who looks at the numbers, and somebody who helps you make adjustments based on their observations, you're good to go.
I would feel very confident head coaching a team if I had all three of those things as well. I think those are wonderful things. I'm going to give a couple of nuances. I have found, I think a lot of our community has observed this, I am more drawn to the developmental side of coaching than the performance side of coaching. So performance would be like top college coaches, professional coaches. That would be the ultimate performance. The ultimate developmental would be youth coaching. And I would argue that developmental coaching would be everything up to varsity basketball. It would be more developmental. I think that varsity basketball begins to transition into performance, but still isn't like the highest level of performance. There's a significant amount of development that should still be approached in at that stage. And then obviously at the highest levels is performance. So I'm going to tweak this question a bit for development purposes, as that's really where my heart is. It's pretty funny. We've got a little local academy, and I would prefer to coach our we call our white team, which is our third and fourth grade girls team. I prefer to coach that team than our, you know, our national traveling high school team. It's amazing how much better they can get so quickly. And that's what excites me. Here are my tweaks for that. One, I would have assistant coaches teaching by roles, R-O-L-E-S roles, not like roles that we're going to eat at Thanksgiving dinner here. Teaching by roles. And so I would have a coach that is specializing in, okay, maybe it's your rackers on offense. And so they are speaking to the rackers that are on the floor during dead balls. They are preparing the rackers on the bench before they sub in. They are teaching on the bench by a role. So when a racker comes out and they need to work on, you know, peeking and throwing bombs more, I can be like, hey, Taylor, talk to her about bombs. And so they're specializing in that. We're really fortunate that we have usually two and sometimes three assistant coaches on the bench, because a lot of times we're playing in a tournament or a league where we have multiple teams. And so we'll have other coaches from other teams just all kind of there. So I would say have them specialize in roles. The three roles that usually we kind of trend towards would be like what we call a wall or more traditional big specialist, who's going to be talking about rebounding, who's going to be talking about burn cuts, who's going to be talking about screen setting, you know, more traditional there, so they can really dive into that. Usually someone that's more like, you know, your primary ball handler, we call a racker, they might specialize in that. And then the other one is really going to be more of like even a defensive focus, who's going to be like our wolf or our lockdown on ball defender. So those are my three favorite roles for teaching. So that would be one development variation. Another development variation would be an emotional coach. This is actually not me. A coach that has their pulse on the emotions of the team, and that whether it be during a timeout or a pregame or whatnot, like either gets them fired up or gets them calmed down, gets them less upset or whatever. It really is like forget all the tactical and technical stuff. We're just not playing hard right now. Or forget, you know, your frustration with the refs, right? We're locking like just an emotional leader. I think that's really, really valuable. And even more so at the developmental side, when the energy of the team has so much more of an impact on their play than even their skill set. Last thing, you mentioned this, and this would go back to the teaching roles a little bit as well. I don't think at the developmental level that you should ever sub for mistakes, right? I believe instead you should sub for teaching. And it would appear similar to a fan, but it would show up very differently on the bench, right? So you sub for a mistake is like you didn't do your job, so you're off and we'll get someone in there to do their job. That'd be more of a performance-based approach. But from a developmental-based approach, it would be like, oh, I need to teach you this thing. The game just showed us that you don't know your job or how to do your job. So let me sub you, Taylor, teach the racker how to do their job. And here's the what I think is really the golden part of this. When you teach someone to do their job, put them back in immediately. So Claire's not doing her job as a racker. She's not throwing any bombs. She's dribbling with her head down, right? Claire, sub. Taylor, teach her how to throw bombs. Taylor, is she ready? 30 seconds later, put Claire right back in. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, they know they're not being subbed out for the mistake because we're not leaving them out as a punishment or consequence. Two, they get a chance to then change it right away instead of sitting for 5 minutes. So they're more likely to add that to their long-term skill set, right? And then three, I think it builds like just trust between you and the player. It's like, hey, when I get a sub, it's not hang my head for punishment. It's eyes up and heart open for coach. Exactly. Right. So those would be a couple of tweaks for just in-game responsibilities and how to use the staff as well.
It makes me excited. I've seen it obviously with our club, with the teams we work with. Two things that got me excited partially with that. One is just so you're talking about development being all the way up to varsity. And one thing I appreciate about Canada basketball, like growing up in Canada, getting my coaching certificate in Canada, I know some people think like the levels are tedious, but part of what I had to do to get my, even to be an assistant coach for a 15U club team, was plan out how you would sub, like what would designate a sub and why. And you had to submit that to an evaluator. So even if you don't use it, you've at least thought about it. And that international scope, like even Canada to the US, but even like in some of the calls that I've had with some of our savvy coaches in the past 2 weeks, I've had calls with a coach from Australia, a coach from New Zealand, a coach from Vietnam, a coach from Europe, and a coach from Canada and the US. Like, we are seeing different styles of basketball, that people approach these things, subbing, coaching, staffs, offense, defense, skills very differently. So that just got me excited. So respect to Canada basketball, long-term athlete development, the fact that they prioritize, their steps are not even called level 1, 2, 3 anymore. It's learn to learn to train, then learn to compete. And learn to compete's not even until you're 16. So that's just a different framing there. And then, related to development, you talked about how that just changes your framework of how you coach, what is important to you. I know we talked about this last week, is Unrivaled. So this new, if you haven't heard about it, Unrivaled is a new women's basketball league in the US. It's an alternative for WNBA players to play in the US in the off season instead of going overseas. What Unrivaled is, it's 3-on-3. It's, I think, a 9-week season. It's in one city. It's more like club teams. So there's all these differences. But one of the things that I've noticed in their marketing, in their development, in their focus, is it's about development. Like, even their head coaches of these pro teams, it's DJ Sackman, it's Phil Handy, it's Teresa Weatherspoon. Like, it's these coaches who aren't head coaches. They're not performance coaches. They're development coaches. And I've seen them do some interviews, and their approach to, yes, performing, getting good reps, but like their focus for the season is very much, how do we get these high level players better? And that's going to change how they coach a team. So I thought that was just an interesting framing and relation.
Okay. I think that's a great transition into our mailbag right now. Question that we get often from coaches when they first join our free community, which if you're not in the free community, please join. I think there's a ton of value in that for you. But they say, well, what college or pro teams run savvy systems? Or, you know, what's the highest level team that runs lock left or whatever? So let me give you an answer and then I'll unpack it. What pro teams run savvy systems? All of them. They are not, probably using our exact terminology, they might use some of it, they are probably not installing it layer by layer as we put it into our classroom. We, savvy, study the absolute best coaches in the world and the best teams in the world. We observe what's working for them, and then we systematize it. So savvy systems are actually just our interpretation of the best way to teach what the top pro or college teams or international teams in the world are running. So it's really actually, the question should be inverted, is who have you studied in order to create the savvy systems? Whether it be our savvy shooting system, whether it be lock left, like who have you studied in order to create this teaching and development framework? And the answer is the best. So recently, Mark and I actually just talked about Oklahoma City Thunder. The Oklahoma City Thunder are probably the most similar defensive approach to what we teach in the lock left right now. Race and space. Every NBA and WNBA team's running race and space. The Las Vegas Aces and the New York Liberty probably are the most race and space-esque. That's who you could look at, right? But it's actually flipped. So I just wanted to clarify that. That's what savvy systems are. Savvy systems aren't, we created this thing in a vacuum and let's see what other coaches and programs are going to do what we say. Savvy systems are, let's look at the ideal, the absolute best in the world, and let's help the majority of coaches and programs get closer to that level of excellence.
Yeah, I agree. And would say some of the teams we've mentioned in the past that have run something similar have changed. we evolve, like the way that I've seen you coach Lock Left, Race and Space has changed over 3 years. The principles remain the same, but it looks different. And so I think some coaches looking at, oh, this specific college team runs something. We tell them that 2 years ago, they go to watch that team this year. And they're like, but it looks different. They have different players. They're playing in a different conference. Like some of the principles stay the same, but they're not running the system as one would just lay it out, you know, blank slate or copycat. So that would be my addition is like these teams at the highest level that you want to emulate are evolving with the times, just as we are evolving how we articulate it, how we teach it, what drills, what we emphasize. Like, again, the principles stay the same, but how it comes across in games and against opponents that are also evolving looks different. So if we say a specific team, you're going to look at them and it's going to look different year to year as well. So not to not study film, not to not look at these teams, but just know that the best coaches out there are evolving and it's going to look different year to year.
3 years ago, we called a transition role a bear. And this transition role was a player that would get back and protect the cave being the smile by the rim. So it's called the bear. And that's that still exists in some of our classroom content. I have since changed the name for how I teach it, whether it be an install. I'm going to North Dakota to go install Lock Left tomorrow, or with our local academies or online. I now call it the wall. Bear has gone to wall. Why has bear gone to wall? Well, here's why bear has gone to wall. One of the most common errors and weaknesses in our Lock Left defense across all teams was having a defender in the half court throughout the entire possession that's occupying the smile or the defensive charge circle. And I said, okay, well, bear kind of worked to get someone there in transition. But then once they matched up, we often did not have a defender actually building a wall between the ball and the rim. And that's really important. It's a weakness. And so by changing the name, it was in line with kind of changing a greater emphasis and focus. We must always have a wall, not just in transition, but throughout the entire possession. And so we renamed the role the wall so that we understand this person might be the wall first, but there's always someone on the wall in the Lock Left defense. So that would be an example of an observation of a weakness of the system and us attempting to address it. So that would be why things change, why systems change, and an example of what Claire was talking about. Hey everybody, this is Tyler, and I'd like to personally invite you to join our free Savvy Coaching community. Post any question you have here in our chat and get your questions answered, as well as get access to all of our free resources in our Savvy community. We've got it all here for you. So click the link below and we'll see you inside. Okay, Claire, question for you. Question comes from coaches. It comes a lot. Actually got this one on YouTube just yesterday as well. What would you suggest doing for pregame warmup?
Might be our most common question. I love it. I love it. So I know we've answered this a lot where it's just like, hey, what do you want to emphasize? What does your team need to be prepared? What is your offensive system? Who are your players? What reps do they need? So what you do in pregame is going to change related to that because it's going to be what you do in pre-practice. But my go-to tangible is honestly attack training. From the time that we've started doing this, every single place that I've gone, every team I've worked with, every game, every practice, I've done some variation of attack training. So if I can get real tangible, other than the whole range from it doesn't matter to do what matters to you, is attack training is so versatile. And what I mean by that is really just some sort of setup where there's people getting reps on both sides of the floor. There's somebody kind of taking it out of bounds or is short corner. There's somebody in the corner. There's somebody up top or on the wing. And you run what you need out of that. So if that is emphasizing your close offs, if that's emphasizing being on the wall, if that's emphasizing being in the gap, like your defensive principles, you can rep that out. if it's just peeking on the catch, if it is communicating on the pass, you're getting those reps. If it is hunting nines and then kicking to a seven, you can get reps in that. If you're past all those fundamentals and you need to work on actions, you can work on your ghosts, you can work on your zooms. Like, it is such a dynamic and versatile setup that works with only three people, but all the way up to 5 to 10, that just do it. You'll find your variation and play around with it that you can do in practice, you can do in a game. Your players will know the organization and then can just communicate what exactly the skill is that you're doing for that 2 minutes. And then keep that set up and just emphasize something different. You can get competitive with it, or you can focus more technique with it. So that's my go-to.
Yeah, beautiful. For those of you that aren't familiar with attack training, this is a quick visual of the setup of it. It's in our drill book with all variations. And your three reasons just to do attack training instead of two-line layups. One, more players, more touches. So in two-line layups, there's like 1.5 players actually touching the ball per rep. And with this, you have 6 players within 5 seconds touching the basketball. As you're working with the basketball on both sides of the floor, both sides of the split line, you get passes involved. But at the very least, you can just go click to click to click and then go dribble in and get your layup, right? If you want to do just layups, right? But you get more players touching the ball, which is a good thing. That's one. Two, there's more of an emphasis on passing than dribbling, which is in line with our principles, right? And then three, it's attacking from our shape or our spots on the floor. Regardless of how you utilize it, those are three reasons why we really like attack training. I would agree with you, Claire. Attack training would be in everything that, in every pregame that I ran. Here's exactly what we do in our pregame, step by step. We go attack training into dominoes into action shooting. That's it. Attack training, dominoes, action shooting. Very, very simple. Everything's in our drill book. I'm not going to teach it all now. It's probably on previous games of the week. If you're not a part of our free community, if you're not a part of our paid community, get access to all of our drill books and all of our practice plans. You can easily find it. The links are going to be down below. We'd love to have you come check it out for free and stay if you want to grow for an entire year with us. There's a question we get a lot as well. How do you attack a box in one or a diamond in one? We get this question a lot because the answer is so frustrating. Develop better players. The only reason a team is going to box in one you or diamond in one you is because you have one really good player and a bunch of other weak players, or just a big difference in skill. And guess what? Every way that you would attack a box in one requires more skill from your other players. There is no silver bullet for this other than get better. Now, there's little things that you can do, but here's what you don't see at higher levels of play: box and ones and diamonds and ones. Because at higher levels of play, you have more skilled players at every position, and it opens up a lot of advantages for the offense on other sides of the floor. So basically you're like, okay, Tyler, that's not very helpful. We can't score when the other team goes box and one because we have one good player. I need some help right now. What do we do? Okay, here's three things that you can do. Race way faster. Every defense, including a box in one, requires them to get set up and get matched up. So if you can get that best player the ball even faster and your players out even faster and they can attack against disorganized defense, you'll have a little bit more margin, a little bit more success. Number two, utilize the person being face guarded as a screener, but not a screener to the perimeter, because your other players probably can't make sevens. They can't even make shots at the perimeter. So use them as a screener to set back screens or flex screens to get players for nines. So use them as a screener for players to the rim, or maybe like a cross screen for a post player coming to the ball side to be able to catch and shoot a nine. So have them screen for nines would be idea number two. Idea number three would be this, and most coaches hate this one, but it's reality. Have them actually stand up near half court the entire possession and let your other players play 4-on-4. Because the more space you have, the more advantages you're going to have. And so if you actually think, well, we actually have some other players that can do some things, just take that player being face guarded out of the play completely and then go play 4-on-4 with more space. So those would be three quick ideas. A game of the week is actually a shooting game. And the shooting game is going to be called double spot shooting. And there's nothing magic about double spot shooting. You can do this. I wouldn't compete with more than three players at a basket for this. Otherwise, that's too much time. Ideally, I like a head-to-head competition as in any shooting ladder. And double spot shooting is just this. You have two shots from a single spot for shootings. If you're watching on YouTube, you'll be able to see. So let's say we're doing double spot shooting and we have player one versus player two. All right, everyone else is at a different basket. So let's say we have two players at a basket. They're doing a head-to-head shooting competition. We're on an even shooting day for those of you that are familiar with our shooting ladders. You can compete for any amount of spots. Let's say we're competing on five spots today for double spot shooting. So we're going to actually start in the corner and we'll be going high wing. We'll be going top of the key, high wing and corner. All right, now we got two spots. Let's say that we have we can have a coach or a third player or an injured player, whatever. They can be the rebounder. So all they're going to do is they're going to get two shots from a single spot. And the first player to make both their shots from the spot wins the spot. Whoever wins the most spots out of five spots wins the day. Double spot shooting. Two shots from a spot. But the first, and they would do it at this spot. Let's say player one wins that spot, right? They get their two shots. They go to the back of the line. And then two gets their turn to get two shots from the spot. All right, real simple. Now, what are you actually doing on this double spot shooting? Well, the first shot on double spot shooting is going to be a blaster, and the second shot is going to be an airdrop. So they have to make a blaster and then an airdrop on double spot shooting. All right, here's an example of a blaster. A blaster is where you blast the basketball between the feet and then off of the bounce. I'm showing this for those of you on YouTube. Off of the bounce, you have to release it. That's a blaster. We'll take a look at Camille here shooting a blaster. You blast the ball between your feet, drop the hips over the ball comes off the ground and off your fingers in one smooth motion. So they'll catch and blaster. You'll see that the feet on a blaster are getting airborne. And so this is a blaster into an air drop. Both your feet get in the air and you drop your hips. The first shot's a blaster. And then the second shot is actually going to be an airdrop. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see the airdrop as well. So this is actually going to be no dribble, just a catch and airdrop. Both feet in the air, drop the hips. So a player will do a blaster, then a player will do an airdrop. If they make both of them, they win the spot. You get a chance to make and match, and they're competing, blaster, airdrop, attempting to win the spot. So three things that we really like about this game or this drill. One, it creates the feeling of speed that we're trying to get players to shoot with off the catch. You would never actually shoot a blaster in a game, but the blaster gets force with the ball coming off the ground and up, so the ball starts to move faster. That's the feeling that we want a player to get on an airdrop. Then they get to actually try to implement that feeling on their second shot on the airdrop. Second thing we love about it is it adds competitive pressure. So that they get to actually shoot against some level of pressure because they're trying to win the spot. Third thing we really like about it, you can use this as a game within the shooting ladder. So let's say that it's, you know, like I said, your one and two spot are competing to try to see if they can flip the spots or not. You can say, hey, we're going to be doing this double shot for our shooting ladder. It fits into what we're doing. And then players can go and work on it on their own as well.
If anyone was wondering, Camille is getting buckets in France.
I'm wondering, how's she doing?
She's doing great. Man, I've seen her on the, I don't know how you pronounce her French team's name, but I see her on their Instagram a lot. 20-point games, 15-point games, bunch of rebounds, bunch of steals, bunch of
everything.
So she's getting buckets. Clearly, this works.
For those of you that don't know, Camille is one of the players that we train at Savvy. She's a pro player. She's played 3-on-3 for Team USA and is featured in a lot of our videos because she's such a great student and also coaches with us. So we're big fans of Camille. I'm happy to hear she's doing well. Okay, Claire. Take us into the Teach Better.
Man, this is, I'm excited about this. So Teach Better this week, how to teach better is by simplifying and enhancing. Our Savvy staff has been focusing on simplify and enhance this quarter. Before I was got into business, I only knew quarters as, you know, 8-minute, 10-minute quarters of a basketball game. In business, they're 4-month segments of the year, 3-month segments of the year, 4 of them throughout the year. But coaches, you can teach better by simplifying and enhancing. So if you don't know already, SAVI is an acronym. There's four letters in it. S-A-V-I. Simplicity, adversity, victory, identity. Simplicity wins. That's the first one. I have been reading the book 4-Hour Workweek by Timothy Ferriss. Saw a quote in there this week that I was like, man, this is so true and so relevant to business, to life, to basketball. So I saw this quote. It says, don't confuse the complex with the difficult. Most situations are simple. Many are just emotionally difficult to act upon. I'll say that again. Don't confuse the complex with the difficult. Most situations are simple. Many are just emotionally difficult to act upon. And we see this a ton with our coaches. Like, do I cut this senior? Do I not play the helicopter parent's kid? How do I hold the standard for a star player? Simplicity wins. You can think of a situation. You know the answer, or at least you know enough to take a step in that direction. So keep it simple and then enhance it. Like, simplicity wins. Simplify. Take away some of the emotion, act on it, see what happens, go from there. So what do I mean by enhance? Like, after simplify, it's an enhance, because simplifying is not going to get everything done in teaching and whatever you're doing. Like, yeah, that's the first step. So by enhance, I really mean embrace adversity. And at SAVI, we know adversity strengthens. And I saw another quote this week. I was like, man, this is great stuff. I'm feeling inspired. I think it was some business owner. It was like, what is the formula for success? Double your rate of failure. I was like, okay, if you want to be successful, fail more. And that's because failure is feedback. Like, failure is feedback. It's just data to learn from and use to enhance. So like, you do any of those tough situations, right? Where it's simple, but it's difficult. Whether that's because of emotion, whether that's because of you're afraid of the consequences, you're not confident, whatever it is, but it's data to use and learn from and enhance. Like, and it's not just verbal feedback, right? I think we think of feedback as, oh, somebody's telling me something, which I know you and Mark talked about last week, which was awesome. Like, seek out feedback. It is going to make you better, but it's not just somebody's opinion that is feedback. It's numbers, it's feelings, it's experiences, it's successes, it's failure, like the good, the bad, the neutral. It's all feedback. And that is a gift that will help you enhance if you choose to receive it that way. And it's up to you to choose what you do with that. So simplify and enhance, embrace simplicity, lean into adversity, because simplicity wins and adversity does strengthen. And I truly think that'll like, if coaches just keep coming back to that at the core of what they do, what they end up executing is going to be better and better, and they'll just kind of keep on that trajectory.
Wise words. I'm just even thinking through so many applications in my own life, in my own coaching, my own leadership. Excellent way to end it. Let me share one addition to the simplicity piece for coaches. And this is my application, even as you were sharing, Claire. Having a mentor or trusted advisor is key on any journey. Having a guide is key on any journey. And that's really our mission and our heart here at SAVI, is we want to be that for you as a coach. We want to be your guide, your mentor, your trusted advisor. We want to be courtside with you. We want to be in the trenches with you. And Mark and I, and Claire as well, are giving video feedback constantly right now as we're in the beginning stage of the season. Mark and I were mentioning this week, like, oh, how many are you doing every single day? How many? And it's a lot. And it's good. We love being able to provide that. Most of the video feedback that we're giving to coaches, they respond with this. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, but it's so good to get that confirmation. And a lot of times, like Claire used the examples of, like, you know, you have to have an emotional conversation, you're emotionally attached. The beauty of having an advisor is they can quickly remove the emotion from it and confirm for you what is the right way forward, because they don't have that barrier of emotion, right? Because they don't have the relationship. They don't have to, you know, see the person every single day. They don't have the muddy emotion. And that's why it's so imperative to have an advisor to help you simplify. It's so obvious to outside eyes what so often internally we get to justify or deny or, you know, feel afraid of. So, you know, and so I would just encourage you, find an advisor, find a mentor. That's what a trusted friend is. And it's really hard to be on any sort of growth journey or to do anything of impact alone. And that's why we do this at Savvy. That's why we're thankful here on this American Thanksgiving Day. We are thankful for all of the coaches that trust us to be that. We do not take that lightly. And we're thankful for you. And we look forward to the next edition of The Hours. Claire, thanks for joining us. Midnight, Bali time. Look forward to next time. Until next time, stay savvy.